I somehow or another knocked this thing off. It's recording and it's locked. It's in the hold position. So if I don't pick that thing up and monkey with it, there's no way it cannot be recording. So I don't know what happened, but I probably did something stupid.
It's not on hold now, though, right?
No, it's locked in to record.
Okay.
That little record thing up there with the knob up.
Okay.
You lock it so that you can't handle it by mistake while you're going through the lesson and turn it off. That's why that lock mode is in there. And so I don't know what happened. But anywho, this is the, what are we, the ninth today?
Yeah.
Does that sound right? Okay.
Better known as Super Bowl Sunday.
I'm sorry?
Better known as Super Bowl Sunday.
Yeah. All right, so this is the ninth. We're in our course on the post-exilic history of Israel. Remember, there's six books that we have to review to get all of that history down. Three historical books, Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther. We've looked at two of those. We've got another one to go this morning. And three minor prophets, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. And we've looked at two of those. And we've got one more of them to look at as well. I don't even want this plate to go back with something on it. You guys take care of that sucker and pass it around. It's all locale. Yeah, sure it is. But, and we made a decision we were going to look at those six books chronologically rather than the way they appear in the canon of Scripture. And that's what we've been doing. So our roadmap to getting through those six books is what you see up here. We began in Ezra. We got through four chapters until he mentioned the ministry of Haggai and Zechariah. So we hopped off the Ezra rails and went over and looked at those two books. Their ministries were primarily a combination of rebuke and encouragement. What happened is when the first returns took place under Zerubbabel, the returnees, the people that had returned, actually got off to a pretty decent start. But it didn't last. They went back in about 436 here under Zerubbabel, and they got off, and their purpose was to rebuild the temple. They got off to a good start for about 2 years, and then they got intimidated into inaction by their enemies. So then they did nothing for about the next 15 years until God sent those two prophets, Haggai and Zechariah, in there to kind of jumpstart the people and get them going again, which they did. And they finished the tabernacle about 20 years after it began in around 516 B.C. But of all that 20-year window, only about 5 years of it was any work on the temple. I think I said tabernacle a while ago. It's a temple. Tabernacle's long gone in the Old Testament era. But that 20 years completed the temple in about 516 B.C. 5 years of work and 20 years and 15 years of non-work, and got that done. Then we went back to Ezra, said, okay, let's go back and resume our search through those books. And we got through chapter 6 of Ezra, and then we stopped and paused and said, well, the book of Esther occurs between chapters 5 and chapter 6 of Ezra, so let's go over and check out Esther. And we did that. And what we saw there was a very clear, detailed description of how God providentially takes care of his children. His name is not mentioned in the book of Esther. I think it's the only book in all of Scripture, all 66 of them, all 800,000 words or more, and his name is not even mentioned in the book. But his hand can be seen at work time and time again. So we looked at Esther. Then we finished that up. We went back to Ezra and finally got through Ezra, chapters 7 through 10. And we ended that last week. That broke off sort of abruptly with Ezra going back to try to be sort of a spiritual guru, a spiritual leader of the folks. He didn't go back to build anything. He went back to try to rebuild their spiritual condition. And he not only, before he could slide off his camel, he runs head on into this problem of they've intermarried with these pagan peoples around them there, mixed marriages. Job one in Israel was no mixed marriages. So the first thing Ezra encounters when he goes back are mixed marriages. So they had to deal with those, and he did, and they put away the wives and the children of the pagan women. And the book kind of ends rather abruptly with no more detail as to what he did while he was there. Very short accounting of Ezra's ministry when he went back. So we're through with that book as well. So now we're going to look at this morning the book of Nehemiah. He will be our next guy. And this his ministry is going to be about, let's see here, maybe 14 years later after Ezra's beginning. So in about 444 B.C., and we'll talk about that date a little bit here this morning, we get our third wave coming together to come back under the leadership of this guy, Nehemiah. We'll see him in just a minute. So we're going to have one wave under Zerubbabel to rebuild the temple, a second wave under Ezra to help the nation spiritually, and a third wave under Nehemiah to rebuild the wall of Jerusalem. So three waves under two builders and one spiritual leader is how the post-exilic history of Israel unfolded.
When you say the wall, is that synonymous with the wall that now exists?
Part of it may be. I'll show you a picture here in just a minute. Okay, so find Nehemiah. It's on page 711. And let's talk about him. Now, these cities back at this time all had to be walled in. The reason for that is that that's the only protection for the cities that they had. The armies would just come in there and just take over the place if they didn't have walls built around them. And Jerusalem was no exception. It originally was built with a wall around them, and some of them were very thick, 10, 20 feet deep. They could drive chariots around the top of a lot of these walled cities. Nebuchadnezzar besieged the place three times, 606, 596, and 586, and it took him that 20-year span of banging on the walls of Jerusalem before he could ever knock them down. They just put a siege up, put these big catapults up there, and start throwing big rocks at the place until eventually it'd knock a hole in the wall or knock enough of it down that the army could breach the wall. And that's how they attacked the city. And it took them 20 years. A good army, an army that knew what they were doing, Nebuchadnezzar's army, took him 20 years to bang on that wall of Jerusalem to get it down to where they could actually take the city. So they would eventually knock the walls down and, of course, burn all of the gates. The gates would be wood, and they would just set the gates on fire and burn them. So by the time you really got something completed, you'd have a pile of rubble and some smoldering wood, and that was the end of the wall of Jerusalem. And so that's what Nebuchadnezzar did to them back in about, well, I think the final collapse was about 586. So that's kind of the background to what we're going to pick up here with Nehemiah's ministry. The place has been kind of hammered into the ground pretty good. Okay, Nehemiah, chapter 1, verse 1. The words of Nehemiah, the son of Haggai. That name means the darkness of the Lord. His father means the darkness of the Lord. Nehemiah's name means the comfort of the Lord. So during his father's era, the city was beat up, and it was a dark time for Israel, to say the least. But Nehemiah, he is a comfort, a source of comfort that God is going to send to the people. So the names kind of capture the history of what's going on here in this place. Now it happened in the month Chislev, in the 20th year, while I was in Susa, the capital, Now, he uses the expression here, it happened. That's all he can use. He doesn't know. But what did we just learn in the book of Esther? Do things just happen? Was it just a coincidence that Esther, this beautiful young lady, and her guardian were role players, big time role players in the history and need of Israel at that time? Did that all just happen? Now, we know who's in charge of what's happening here. But in this particular case, this date is 444 BC. Who cares? Well, I care. You probably would care too, if you knew what I'm going to tell you, and you did know it already probably. I'm going over to the book of Daniel. Now, Daniel was there, remember, early on in the Babylonian Empire. I'm thinking we're in like maybe the 530s and something like that in Daniel, and we're in the 430s, 100 years later or so, in Nehemiah. And let me just read you a tad bit about what Daniel knows. I'm in Daniel chapter 9, verse 29. Now I was speaking and praying and confessing my sin and the sin of my people, Israel, and presenting my supplication before the Lord my God in behalf of the holy mountain of my God. While I was still speaking in prayer, the man Gabriel, is he a man? You look like one, but that's actually Gabriel, an angel, whom I had seen in the vision previously, came to me in my extreme weariness about the time of the evening offering, about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. This angel appears to Daniel because he's been sent there by God. And he gave me instruction and talked with me, and he said, "Oh, Daniel, I have now come forth to give you insight with understanding. I got a message for you, Daniel. I'm going to tell you something, something cool you don't know yet. At the beginning of your supplications, the command was issued," that was like days before, "and I have come here to tell you because you're highly esteemed, so give heed to the message and gain understanding of the vision. 70 weeks." What in the heck is that? Well, the word weeks is a Hebrew word that means a unit of seven, just like a decade's a Greek term that means 10. This shabna, this word, is seven. So 70 times seven, if I remember right, that's 490 years, or determined, that 490-year interval will complete something. 490 years have been decreed. Decreed. Who decrees things in the Word of God? God does, doesn't he? God has established that in a 490-year interval, Israel's history, well, let's see what he says. Let him tell us what's in there. "Have been decreed for your people and your holy city." This is going to involve Jerusalem and the Israelites. "To finish about six different things. It's going to finish the transgression, to make an end of sin, to make an atonement for iniquity," that's three. "Four is to bring in everlasting righteousness. Five is to seal up vision and prophecies. And six is to anoint the most holy place." Six different facets to God's theocratic program for Israel and Jerusalem will be completed at the end of 490 years. Got the picture? God tells him how long it's going to take for him to complete his program for the Abrahamic covenant as pertained to Israel in the Old Testament era. "So you are to know and discern that from the issuing of a decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem," what's that? That's what Nehemiah gets. We'll see that in just a second. So from the decree that Nehemiah gets to, let's see what's going to happen at the end of that, "to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince," there will be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. That's 69 of the 70. 69 of the 70 units of seven, 483 years will elapse from the time that that Nehemiah gets his decree, that we'll see here in just a moment, to the coming of Messiah. It will be that 483 years. And Messiah the Prince will be cut off. The city will be rebuilt again, the wall with plaza and moat, even in times of distress. It won't be easy to get this job done. But after the 62 weeks, that's 62 plus the 7, 69 weeks, after the 483 years, the Messiah will be cut off and have nothing, and the people of the prince who is to come will destroy the city and sanctuary. That will be the Romans. And its end will come with a flood, even to the end there will be war, desolations are determined. Now, let's see the decree, and then we can put together the whole picture. So back to Nehemiah. Hananiah, one of my brothers, and some men from Judah came, and I asked them concerning the Jews who had escaped and had surveyed the captivity and about Jerusalem. So Jeremiah has some buds come. Well, it looks like his brother, probably a blood brother. And he asks about the well-being of his beloved city, Jerusalem. And his brother says to him, the remnant there in the province who have survived the captivity are in great distress and reproach. And the wall of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates are burned with fire. So the report that Nehemiah got about the well-being of the city of Jerusalem is that the thing is in shambles. The wall broken down, the gates are burned with fire, the people there are living in great distress. It's a disaster back in Jerusalem, Nehemiah. Now, would one think that Nehemiah necessarily would care? Why is it Nehemiah's problem to worry about the condition of the place? He is in the government of the Persian Empire at a high level. He's actually the cup bearer of the king. We'll see that in just a minute. But what does he care about the condition of Jerusalem? Look how he responds, verse 4. Came about when I heard these words that I sat down and wept and mourned for days, and I was fasting and praying before the God of heaven. This guy's a Daniel wannabe. He cares about his people. He goes into mourning when he hears that the city is a wreck. The walls torn down and nobody can build and live there safely. The people in great distress. He does care. How is it that this news about the city falls upon the ears of someone who cares? Remember in the book of Esther, the distress that was going to come upon the Jews fell on Mordecai's ears, and he cared. How come it just happens that God is bringing this information to his people who care? That sounds to me like somebody's in control. Kind of like a providential thing going here again, isn't it?
And not only do they care, but they're in position to do something about it.
Absolutely. Their heart is right. Yeah. And remember, Esther was too.
Yes.
So all of these people that we're seeing now in this history are in positions to impact the situation. God has put in place his people, the right people, the people he wanted there, in the right positions so that both their attitude and their actions can help his people. Esther, Nehemiah, and Daniel are three really good examples. How about Joseph? He's cleaning toilets in the prison. Next thing you know, he's second in command in all of Egypt because God put him there. There's no such thing as a coincidence, people. God manipulates his creation as he so wishes because it's his creation. He can do whatever he wants to with it. Put people in place, cross paths, take actions, whatever. And we're seeing that same truth unfold here in Nehemiah's life. So Nehemiah is just very upset by hearing this sad news that the city is in such bad shape. And so he starts fasting and praying, and I said, I beseech thee, O Lord God of heaven, the great and awesome God who preserves the covenant and loving kindness for those who love him and keep his commandments. Obedience brings blessing, disobedience brings judgment. That is a theology of the book of Deuteronomy that applies to all of Israel's history. Let thine ear now be attentive and thine eyes open to hear the prayer of thy servant, which I am praying before thee now, night and day, in behalf of the sons of Israel, thy servants, confessing the sins of the sons of Israel, which we have sinned against thee. Notice he puts himself in a position of sharing the responsibility for the judgment on the people because of their sins, although we don't see anything that he did, but nevertheless, he joins in with them in the confession. We've acted very corruptly against thee, have not kept the commandments, nor the statutes, nor the ordinances which thou hast commanded thy servant Moses. The condition of the nation is the result of sinfulness on the part of the people. They were judged by the Babylonian captivity, and the residue of that judgment is still in place there in Jerusalem. They got them a temple up, but the place is really not inhabitable yet. So, verse 8, remember the word which thou didst command thy servant Moses, saying, if you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the peoples. That was promised to them, and that happened to them. But if you return to me and keep my commandments and do them, though those of you who have been scattered were in the remotest part of the heavens, I will gather them from there and will bring them to the place where I've chosen to cause my name to dwell. So God has told the nation, and repeatedly, if they will repent, he will heal them, put them back together, restore the blessings that he has removed in judgment. And they are thy servants and thy people whom thou didst redeem by the great power and by the strong hand. O Lord, I beseech thee, may thine ear be attentive to the prayer of thy servant and the prayer of thy servants who delight to revere thy name and make thy servant successful today and grant him compassion before this man. This man is going to be the king of the Persian Empire that he's referring to. Now, I was the cupbearer to the king. Wow. This is a Jew. The Persian king is trusting Nehemiah the Jew to make sure no one poisons him with the wine that he gets. So Nehemiah's job in the empire is to keep the king alive. He drinks everything before the king drinks it. If Nehemiah hits the floor, they'll know that somebody's trying to poison the guy. His job is to make sure that doesn't happen. You think the king might have some confidence in him? Who are you going to trust to make sure no one poisons you? You got anybody you can trust? The king has got Nehemiah. Obviously, he is a man of character, and the king has somehow recognized that down through the years, and he is in this position now of being at the king's elbow. Esther was his wife, or one of their wives. Daniel was very esteemed in the governmental affairs of Babylon. And it transitioned over, it looks like, into the Persian Empire as well. So these men that God has chosen and women that he's put in the right place at the right time are people of character, and they're being recognized by a godless empire that a godly person can indeed be someone to be trusted and so on. So we got a guy, again, much like Esther was, in the kingdom at a high position to be able to interact with the leadership of the Persian Empire. This time, it's Nehemiah. So it came about, I'm in chapter 2, verse 1, it came about in the month Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, that wine was before him, and I took up the wine and gave it to the king. Now, I had not been in his presence, so he hadn't, had not been sad in his presence. You couldn't be sad in the king's presence. So when Nehemiah shows up for work that day, he's got a little bit of a sad look on his face because he knows his people are in distress in Jerusalem. And the date that he gives us is 444 BC at a certain month, at a certain date. Now, what's going to happen here, I'll give you a little sneak preview ahead of time, is that the king is going to decree that Nehemiah can go back to Jerusalem and rebuild the wall. That date, 444 BC, in that month of Nisan, is the date that Daniel was told by Gabriel is the beginning of 483 years until Messiah would come and he would be cut off by the Romans. So any Hebrew scholar worth his weight in salt could look at this and say, wait a minute now, 483 days from this particular date, this decree, is when Messiah is going to come. So I know the date that he's supposed to be here. I can count days. I can put a date on the day that he will come and appear. Furthermore, I also know Zechariah 9:9, because it told me he's going to come on a donkey. So I know the day that he's coming. I know the manner of his coming. So how is it when Jesus came on that date riding a donkey, they didn't know who it was? Their scriptures, their scholarship should tell them the day and the manner, the very day that Messiah would come. How many other guys come to the nation Israel claiming to be Messiah riding a donkey? How many guys that want to take over the place present themselves to the people on a donkey? Even if they didn't get the date perfectly right. How many did that? And they didn't get it. They missed it. They chose not to believe that he was who he claimed to be, with the evidence of time and manner right in their face. It's inexcusable. And God judged them because of that. A few years later, they were essentially destroyed by the Romans, lost any national identity at all, and they didn't get it back till 1948, 2,000 years later. That was a tough judgment, but it was inexcusable. They knew the day, and they knew the manner, and they rejected him. So Nehemiah's petition here, as we will see as it develops here in just a bit, marks the start of that 483 years. But wait a minute. The prophecy said that 490 years are determined before it's all over. We're missing 7 years. Where'd that go? We can account for 483 years of that statement, that prophecy. But it said, the prophecy said, it will take 490 years to complete God's dealing with the nation Israel. So, I can't close this loop 100% yet because I'm missing 7 years. I wonder where that 7 years is. I don't see it anywhere. That 7 years hasn't happened yet. But it's going to happen. And that 7 years will complete Israel's eschatology prior to the millennial kingdom. Everything about the Abrahamic covenant up to the beginning of the millennial kingdom will end when that next 7 years runs its course. Well, gosh, how in the world would we define that? Well, we know exactly how to define it. Daniel tells us how it's going to begin. Back there in chapter 9, where I was reading a while ago, I stopped at verse 27. And he will make a firm covenant with the many for 1 week, one unit of 7 years. This guy, we call him the Antichrist, along with 32 other names. He will make a covenant with Israel for a 7-year period of time. It sounds like Israel will be happy and contented to enter into a treaty with this guy that's supposed to run 7 years. Why would Israel need a treaty? Treaties usually end wars, don't they? Israel's going to be at war when this thing starts. I thought it was already started a while back, but it didn't go the way I thought it was going to. But it will go some way soon. And they think they're safe under his leadership and control and protectorate. But I'm still in verse 27, Daniel chapter 9. In the middle of the week, in the middle of the 7-year run, 3.5 years after the treaty is signed, he will put a stop to the sacrifice and grain offering, that is the worship of God, in the temple that is in place during the tribulation period. That will stop at midpoint. And on the wings of abomination will come one who makes desolate, even until a complete destruction is decreed. That's the Antichrist. So we know the 7 years that we're missing yet in this prophecy will begin with Israel signing a treaty with the Antichrist. And we know from other chapters in Daniel 2, 7, and 8 primarily, that is a 10-nation federation of old European countries that the Antichrist will be heading up. So we're going to have to see, somebody will see it, we may not see it, somebody's going to have to see a movement toward a 10-nation unifying conglomerate of some kind involving old European countries, and that unit, headed up by the Antichrist, will be how Israel's war ends, and they think they're safe. But in 3.5 years later, he says, I was just kidding. I'm taking over now. You're going to worship me. Sets himself up in the temple as the object of worship. The Antichrist. 33 different biblical names. Antiochus Epiphanes is a prefiguring of him. Syrian king, 175-165 BC. A descendant of Alexander the Great's generals, one of them. He depicts all of this for us. You can go study the life of Antiochus Epiphanes, and you can see this life before it happens, the Antichrist's life. So, we've accounted for 483 years. We know there's another 7 missing. We know how it will begin, and we also know how the midpoint changes everything, and we know how it ends. Chapter 19 of the book of Revelation. The Lord comes back and stomps it all. So, this date that Nehemiah is talking about here, this rather insignificant kind of brushing through this date, is in very, very significant because it tells us when the Messiah was going to come, how they will reject him, in effect. And we're still waiting for that last 7 to crank up. So he's sad. Nehemiah is having a bad day. Not only a bad hair day, he's having a bad face day. And the king sees him. He asks him in verse 2, why is your face, and though you, why is your face sad, though you're not sick? There's nothing but sadness of heart, then I was very much afraid. So, I mean, if this guy was wanting to be a real tyrant that day, he could just kill old Nehemiah because he came in there with a sad look on his face. That'd be fun, wouldn't it? So the king said to me, what would you request? So I prayed to the God of heaven. Once again, we have this pagan king asking this Jewish guy, what do you want me to do for you? What's the chances of that happening? And whatever God wants it to be. And that's the only explanation for that. So Nehemiah puts up a quick prayer. And I said to the king, verse 5, if it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor before you, send me to Judah, to the city of my father's tombs, that I may rebuild it. So Nehemiah takes advantage of this wonderful offer, and he said, if you're cool with this, send me back to Judah, and I'll rebuild this city and the wall around it so we can live in the place. You think there's a chance in the world that Nehemiah could have gone in there without divine providence, greasing all these skids and say, hey, king, old buddy, old pal, how about me going back to Jerusalem for a while? That would have been the end of him. Clearly, there is divine providence guiding all of these events, as we saw in the book of Esther. So the king responds back to him, verse 6, the queen sitting beside him, whoops, careful, Nehemiah, and she says, well, how long would journey be, and when will you return? Clearly, he wasn't real thrilled about losing Nehemiah, a trusting servant, and so on. Says, how long are you going to be? And so he gave him a definite time. I don't know if it gets extended once or twice or what happens, but he's actually gone 12 years. I don't think that was probably the original intent, but it takes him a little while to get into some of this stuff and get these things done. So he then asks the king, the Persian king, which one we got here? This is Artaxerxes. He asks to go back in 444 B.C. and start rebuilding the wall and the city of Jerusalem. So the builders of concrete and straw and stuff are Zerubbabel and Nehemiah. Ezra is a spiritual leader. He's trying to help the people spiritually. These guys are trying to build the place so they can live safely in it. So, he then asks, in verse 7, if it pleases the king, let letters be given me for the governors of the provinces beyond the river, that they may allow me to pass through until I come to Judah. He needs some kind of authorization to show other peoples here between Susa and Jerusalem that he is a legitimate emissary of the Persian king. So he gets some papers that tell them who he is and what he's up to and all this stuff. And a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make, beams for the gates, and for the fortress which is by the temple, for the wall of the city, and for the house to which I will go. And the king granted them to me, and he understands why, because the good hand of my God was on me. Nehemiah sees what's happening here. He knows who's the driving force behind all of this. And so he's now gotten permission to get the materials that he needs to do this job. He's going to get wood from the king's forest and other things. So then I came to the governors of the provinces beyond the river, that is beyond the Euphrates. He's going down toward Judah. And I gave them the king's letter. Now the king had sent me officers of the army and horsemen. So he's got a protective guard traveling with him. And when Sanballat, the Horonite, and Tobiah, the Ammonite official, heard about it, it was very displeasing to them that someone had come to seek the welfare of the sons of Israel. Well, who are these characters? Well, they're Israel's enemies. These are Samaritans. Here's Judah. Here's where Nehemiah is coming back to. And here's Samaria right here. Sanballat is the governor of Samaria. He's in control of all of this area, and he doesn't want these guys to rebuild this place. That's going to impinge on his budding empire. So he's not going to be a happy camper. And he's got this other guy. hanging around with him here. I don't know who he is. Tobiah the Ammonite. So Nehemiah runs headlong into opposition as soon as he gets there. Bad guys. These guys got the black hats on. Nehemiah's got a white hat on. So the story was real sweet until we got to that verse, wasn't it? Got permission to go, got resources to help do all of this. Things were going along real well, and we run into these stinkers that are going to get in the way. I wonder if God can run over them in the process of helping out Nehemiah. I would be a lot more concerned about what God wanted done than what this guy does or did not want done. Now here's what he is going to try to rebuild. The shaded wall is apparently the, I say apparently because I don't know of anybody that was here now that saw it personally, but this is the wall that is torn down and the city would be inside here. There's where they think the temple would be up here in this particular area here. Who knows? If you search for this online, this is what you get. It's probably reasonable. It's probably not precise, but it's probably reasonable. Probably good enough that we can use it for a object to follow Nehemiah's work. 12 gates. I don't know how big the wall was, how thick it was, but if it took Nebuchadnezzar 20 years to bang it down, I'm thinking that's a pretty good looking wall. So, Nehemiah gets there. We were talking a little bit last week about this trip, this 3.5 month trip. And I'm thinking, man, you stop and think about every day for 3.5 months, you got to pull the caravan up, put it in park. You got to go find some water somewhere for both yourself and the animals. You got to find some food somewhere. You can carry some and get part of the way maybe for both you and the animals. You set your tent up, build a fire, try to eat, try to take care of the animals, and you hit it. Next day, same thing over again. Where do you find the water? You got to camp near water to do that. These caravans, this journey, is 3.5 month journey. I mean, man, that sounds like a bunch of work, especially the big caravan, the 50,000 caravan. Where's there enough water for animals? 50,000 people. I don't know how they got there, but they did. He got there. And he doesn't waste any time hitting it. Verse 11 of chapter 2. So I came to Jerusalem, and I was there 3 days. And apparently he doesn't tell anybody what he's up to. And I arose in the night, I and a few men with me. I didn't tell anyone what my God was putting into my mind to do for Jerusalem. And there was no animal with me except the animal on which I was riding. So I went out at night by the valley gate. So he starts his inspection of what's left here at the valley gate. See where that is? Kind of down here in the middle. He starts here to inspect this wall and to see, you know, try to start to size up what this job is. How big a job is this? In the direction of the Dragon's Well and onto the refuse gate. That would be the dung gate down there at the bottom. That's where they dump the trash and everything for burning down there to the outside the walls. So it looks like he's starting there at about the valley gate and then doing a counterclockwise loop around the wall. Inspecting the walls of Jerusalem, which were broken down, and its gates, which were consumed by fire. They can't burn the stone, but you can burn the gates out of the place. I passed on to the fountain gate. So he's looping around the south end of it, it looks like here. He's come down this way. to here. I remember he's having to progress through a bunch of rubble because the stones are all torn up. I passed on to the fountain gate in the king's pool, and there was no place for my mount to pass. He couldn't even get his donkey through the rubble. It was so thick. So I went up at night by the ravine and inspected the wall, and then I entered the valley gate again and returned. So he looked at it as best he could, and the officials did not know where I had gone or what I had done, nor had I as yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, or the rest who did the work. So nobody knows yet what he's up to. He's just sizing this thing. He's trying to get a feel for how big a job is it to rebuild that wall. So he inspects it as much as he can. And apparently the pile of rubble in some places was so high and whatnot that he couldn't even get his donkey through there. So I said to them, "You see the bad situation we are in, that Jerusalem is desolate, its gates burned by fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem that we may no longer be a reproach." A city without a wall is worthless. They've got to rebuild this wall, which includes these 12 gates in it. But when Sanballat, the Horonite, and Tobiah, the Ammonite official, and we've got a third guy here, Geshem, the Arab, heard it, they mocked us and despised us and said, "What is this thing that you're doing? Are you all rebelling against the king?" So the enemies pulled the same stunt they did against Zerubbabel when they tried to build the temple. They mocked them. They try to humiliate them. They try to discourage them in any way they can to not do this. So the enemies of God, the servants of Satan, are just like you would expect them to be, trying to get in the middle of this thing and block it somehow. So I answered them and I said to them, verse 20, "The God of heaven will give us success. Therefore, we, his servants, will arise and build. And you have no portion, right or memorial, in Jerusalem." So Nehemiah gives them an earful, his enemies, right off the bat. "You ain't going to have anything to do with this. Get out of the way. We're going to build this, and God will bless our building of it." Okay, we may stop here because the building starts next time, and we'll try to take that from the beginning. That's the project. Kind of see how things are going? Geez, I wonder if they'll be successful. They're going to rebuild that whole sucker in 52 days. 52 days. That is only explainable, I think, like other things that we're seeing, as being a divine blessing, because that job is bigger than a 52-day job. Again, now I don't have dimensions for the wall. I wish we knew a little more about it, but if it's typical, gosh, the thing's probably at least 10 feet deep, probably 20. So they got to move all these stones and put them back in place and get some more stones from wherever they can and get the rubble all built back into a cement-like, concrete-like element to piece everything together. So we'll see how he goes about this and how he handles his enemies, the satanic enemies of this project. If he knows what we know, he expected that. He knew that. He knew God's enemies would try to oppose this, just like God's enemies try to oppose everything God tries to do. If you're going to serve the Lord in any capacity in this life, you're going to encounter opposition, no matter what it is. It may seem small and insignificant. You will encounter satanic opposition to any work that God tries to do. He's relentless and resourceful and a ever-present foe to divine purpose. And Nehemiah probably was expecting it, and just a matter of time to size it up and see how it goes and so on, but that should be expected by anybody. So any questions or comments about Nehemiah? We got that time marker from the decree for him to go back there to do this down to when Messiah would appear on Palm Sunday. We got that time marker started with this decree here in Nehemiah chapter 1. It was told to Daniel about 100 years before this that would mark a 483-year period of time for Messiah to come. And it left 7 years to be figured out where that is from the prophecy of 70 times 7 that was given to Daniel by Gabriel. So this particular event and Daniel's event are very much related and very much defining the remainder of Israel's history, less these last 7 years. And if you want to see what those are all about, go look at Revelation 6 through 19, and you'll see those 7 years being worked out. Questions, comments?
If it took him 52 days, why was he gone for 12 years?
I guess he wanted to stay as he's a governor of Judah, and I guess he wanted to stay to help in other ways. And I'm sure he got an extension approved. I don't think he just blew off the king. That would be dangerous. But he wasn't governor much after that, so his tenure didn't last too much beyond the 12 years. Maybe when he went back, they replaced him in that role, and that may be why it didn't last very long. So, everybody cool? All right. Next week, lunch is on Bob. We'll talk about it next week and make sure everybody knows how to get there. And hopefully Rosa, I'll call her and try to talk to her and tell her and see if she can join us. Okay, any other questions, comments? All righty, we will see you next week.
So where is the North American?
You say, where was it going to be?
Where is it going to be? Because if it's all going to be just...
Oh, the tribulation. It's a good question, but the implication is that the whole Western Hemisphere plays a very small role in anything other than the destruction of the planet. Because there's no indication that the United States or anybody in the Western Hemisphere has anything to do with the Antichrist and his group and all that stuff. It's like we just have no significant role. The church is gone, and what's left is a bunch of godless left-wing Marxists, and Israel won't want anything to do with them. So they turn to the Europeans, who convince them that they're safer with them than with anybody else. And if we're gone, you know, all of the Trump administration, for example, if it happens quickly, they're all gone, and all that conservative leadership is gone. So why would Israel want anything to do with us? And apparently they don't. They sign up with the Europeans. So the answer to your question, we are just reduced to kind of insignificance, it looks like. But we'll be destroyed. We'll be part of the destruction because you got to get 99% of the people killed off. So the Western Hemisphere has got to be slaughtered with something. The natural disasters, military disasters, the pestilence disasters of COVID-19 type stuff going on, all of that appears will take them out, as much of the Eastern world is the same way. You got to involve the Asians because you can't get to the number of deaths if you killed every man, woman, and child in North America, South America, and Europe. You still have to kill half of Africa to get to that 1.8 billion people. So you got to get the Asians involved, Pakistan, India, some of China, some of Southeast Asia. Those people have got to be involved to get the numbers up, to get to that 1.8 billion. So there will be deaths happening all over the place, but apparently not much else. Apparently we don't do much of anything else in the Western Hemisphere. Weapons of mass destruction of every kind will be used. nuclear weapons, germ warfare, everything. Plus, then you get in all these natural disasters, tidal waves, you know, earthquakes. Okay, San Andreas Fault, you know, opening up and this kind of stuff. It's just unimaginable.
The hospital together, you can take it apart.
Yeah. The hospitals can't process the dead. They're so high, it's almost as if there's no response, nowhere to turn to of any kind. And with pestilence and all that stuff being involved as well, how are they going to do anything? Nowhere to turn. People will be dying like flies. It's hard to imagine because there's nothing in our experience that gives us a feel for that. We haven't seen billions of people killed by natural disasters and wars and pestilence and famine and beasts. Animals are going to be killing a bunch of people. I mean, I guess people become dog food and the beasts start killing people. That's right. That's right. That judgment is just. Well,
I think we talked about that. I like these sections quite a bit.
Absolutely. I don't want to have to eat that. How's your mom doing? You guys gonna take her out for Valentine's Day? Or go over to her place or something?
You know, she'd just rather stay at home and we
bring something to her. Yeah, that's cool too. So, probably safer that way.
Yeah, by the time you get her dressed, get her going, get her out.
Yeah.
And if she needs to use the restroom, that's kind of
thing. Yeah. Yeah, I hear you. Well, tell her we said hey. She probably won't remember who we are. But.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I don't know. She does.